I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. White collar and blue collar, move over. Green is the new thing. During his campaign, President-elect Barack Obama promised to invest $150 billion over 10 years to create 5 million new green-collar jobs. As president-elect, he's announced a plan for an emergency stimulus package that would include funds to develop environmentally friendly technologies. The goal is simple enough: reduce waste and pollution while creating a new economy. But how much of this plan is possible in the near future, and where will these jobs be located, and who will get them? For answers, we turn to Van Jones. He is the author of The Green Collar Economy: How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems. Nice to have you on the show. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with this. What is a green collar job, and where can I find one if I need one?
Well, a green collar job is really a blue collar job that's been upgraded to better respect the environment. So you want to think about not the PhDs, but the PhDs, you know, the skilled laborers, the people who are putting up those solar panels, people who are manufacturing wind turbines, weatherizing and retrofitting buildings so they don't leak so much energy, people who are involved in water conservation, urban gardening, all of the hard and skilled and smart work that is required to help beat global warming. The good thing about a green collar job is everything that is good for the environment, that's good for energy independence, that's good for the fight against global warming, is a job. Solar panels don't put themselves up. And so the same things that can be used to beat global warming can also be used to power our way through the recession.
So green jobs would include things that require brain power as well as brawn power.
Exactly. You're talking about restoring the dignity of work, of skilled labor. We built this country with smart, skilled workers, and then we sent all those old blue-collar jobs overseas. Well, the good thing about a lot of these green-collar jobs is that many of them cannot be outsourced. If you're going to put up a solar panel or if you're going to weatherize a house, you can't send that building over to China or to Asia and have them do it on the cheap, bring that building back over here. Wind turbines are so heavy. They have 8,000 finely machined parts. Wind towers are 20 tons of steel. So it's better to make them close to where they're going to be put up, say in our plain states. So you could put Detroit back to work. You're talking about a bailout. You could put Detroit back to work, not making SUVs that would destroy the world, but making wind turbines and solar panels that would help save the world, bail out the people and the planet.
Now, whenever new technologies are created, there are always shadow sides that are discovered along the way. What are some of the potential pitfalls, if there are any, of green jobs and technologies?
Well, you know, there are some concerns that, you know, solar panels, the way that they're made right now, the technology that we have right now, does produce some toxins. Wind turbines, for instance, we've got the right speed, so they don't kill as many birds. They do, though, unfortunately, kill an awful lot of bats. There's nothing that's perfect, but the question is, are those trade-offs worth it? If we keep trying to drill and burn our way out of our energy problems, our world scientists tell us we're going to cook the whole planet, and then we won't have birds or bats or anything else. So I think the most important thing we can do right now is to continue to try to invent and invest our way out by following up on the president-elect's green-collar jobs and energy independence agenda.
Are you suggesting there will be some energy-related collateral damage, if I can put it that way?
Well, there are always trade-offs, but I will say this. There are many more jobs that are available. For instance, there's something that came out called the Green Recovery Report from the Center for American Progress, where I am a senior fellow. And that report shows that for $100 billion of investment, you could create 2 million jobs in the United States in the next 2 years. Now, we're talking about 20 years from now. We're not talking about some space-age fantasy. We mean in the next 2 years, you could create 2 million jobs, weatherizing buildings, retrofitting buildings, deploying existing technologies like caulk guns, as well as solar panels to help us conserve energy and at the same time set us up to go from being the world leader in environmental pollution to being the world leader in environmental solutions as a country.
Let me follow up that point with this. Just after the election, We saw some infighting among Democrats in Congress. Representative Henry Waxman of California, for example, challenged Representative John Dingell of Michigan for chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Waxman won that battle, and he is reportedly more eco-minded than Dingell. Does this signal, in your mind, a change happening on Capitol Hill when it comes to environmental issues?
I think it signals Capitol Hill finally catching up to the rest of the country. If you look at the polling data, Americans are very, very committed to a clean energy future, to energy independence. Riding the bucking bronco of gas prices creates a lot of uncertainty. Even when prices are down, you don't know how long they're going to be down. Americans want energy independence. Unfortunately, we've allowed Detroit, which is really the heart of our industrial capacity, to stay wed to a very outdated set of strategies. And now we have an opportunity. I think if we move forward, we can put this country back to work building the energy infrastructure to harness our clean energy power centers and connect them to our population centers. We have a Saudi Arabia of wind in this country. We should never forget that in our plain states. We have a Saudi Arabia of solar in this country, in the Sun Belt. Our challenge is just to build all the things that we need to build to connect those clean energy power centers to our population centers and begin to lead the world again in clean energy.
Here's my final question for you, and I have less than a minute for you to respond. The president-elect's vision for a green economy, his stimulus package plans to include funds for new environmental technologies. Do you have any sense of what the details of that are going to look like?
Well, my hope is that he will, set standards and let technologists figure out the technology. But I think that there is a strong interest in smart biofuels, advanced geothermal, certainly advanced solar. And the good thing is that, low-income people and people of color who maybe did not have good opportunities in the pollution-based economy will have many more opportunities in this economy.
That's an interesting point. Van, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Van Jones is the author of The Green Collar Economy, How One Solution Can Fix Our Two Biggest Problems.
We've been talking about one industry, the auto business, and now we're going to talk to one man at an economic crossroads. James Smith lives in Southern California. He was working in a plant assembling lawn sprinklers up until September when he was laid off. James, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. You got in touch with us through an outreach that we put on our blog, and we were really moved by what you had to say, but also just the clarity with which you said it. And it had so much to do with your desire to be a husband, earning money, and living some form of the American dream. So let's break down a little bit more where things have gone for you. So you were working for a plant that was assembling lawn sprinklers. What did they tell you about your job and when?
Well, they actually told me earlier that month that we would be laid off for December and that we would return to work in January. It was actually a temporary job, but I was on track to become a permanent employee. And a week later, they came in and said, we no longer need you, and we'll see what happens in January.
So you had no time to really get comfortable in that job?
I'd been there for a year.
I see. Okay. So it was in September, though, that they told you that they were going to have to let people go in December?
Right. That we were going to be leaving in December, but we would be coming back.
Right. What are the signs now?
Truth be told, I'm terrified. I don't think we're coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Building is down drastically in this country right now. And if there are no buildings, there are no need for landscape fixtures.
Right. So when will you find out?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea at this point.
You're just waiting for a call.
Any call from anyone. Anywhere.
So are you actively out looking for something else more stable?
On a daily basis.
What are you finding?
Finding nothing. Even the jobs that supposedly no one wants are being filled by PhDs, basically.
Yeah. Now, you've had some tough moments in your life before. You you ended up out of the Marine Corps going into addiction and then going into prison as well. So tell me about how you think some of the things that you went through affected you for better and worse. And what I mean was, you've already been through an incredible journey to pull your life to where it is now. At the same time, doesn't it hurt you when you go for jobs to have a record?
It hurts me in a number of different ways. One, you know, legally, I guess no one can be honest about it. When I go into an interview and I tell them that I've been to prison, and I ask them with all due sincerity, please, is this going to affect me? And they say no. And I know I'm qualified and in a lot of times overqualified for the positions. And I don't get a call back, or I call back and they just won't talk to me at all. It hurts financially. It hurts emotionally. I feel that I'm no longer even an American citizen. I'm unworthy, in a way.
Does it also hurt that you are someone who's served the country, you know, in the military, and that you're in this position? I mean, do you think there? Who do you? It sounds like you've taken a lot of responsibility in trying to get out there and take care of yourself, but also, do you think there's anyone else who could be of more help, or who should be of more help to you?
You know, I would love to say that I know who should be of help, but I don't. I understand how people feel. I understand I've committed a crime, and I don't expect full trust, but I mean, as a former Marine, I feel as though I've been labeled traitor, and I don't know who to ask for help. I go to the different organizations, and they say that they give me advice on how to get a job and send me back out, and it's, you know, I've been out there.
What about your wife? You're married, and so is she trying to encourage you?
She's trying to. She's trying to, and I don't know if she does it intentionally or not, but every now and then she'll say something that just hits straight to the bone, and I think it's me. I think I'm just becoming a little sensitive and a little tender about it now.
Do you think that, do you have, and I know this is a delicate question, do you have it in you to deal with this for another month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, however long it takes?
Well, actually, I'm falling back on military training, and the fact is that I have no choice, and therefore it will be.
So you're just going to tough it out?
I have no other choice.
What if you end up without a home again?
Then I will be homeless. I've been considering taking what little money I have and expatriating.
Mm-hmm. Where would you go?
Actually, I'm looking at Dubai and Costa Rica and any number of places. Somewhere where someone might overlook the fact that I have made a mistake and will let me show them, as I have for the last 10 months working, let me show them that I can do this.
Well, I really appreciate you being so honest and open about your journey, and I think that a lot of people listening will also appreciate the roads that you've walked and what you've offered us today. So let's stay in touch, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
That was James Smith, who was recently laid off from a manufacturing job. He's now collecting unemployment and working to find work in Southern California. As part of our month-long film series, today we're going to take a look at, or rather, take a listen to, the role of music in the movies. We're going to hear from two musical giants in the film score industry. First, Stanley Clarke. He's a legendary jazz bassist, orchestrator, conductor, and film score writer. He's composed music for more than 65 movies, including The Transporter and Boys in the Hood. Thank you. In the 1970s, Stanley Clark made a name for himself playing bass, but for the past 25 years, he's been turning his energy to film and television scoring. Clark's now one of the most in-demand composers in Hollywood.
Many of the films that I do are very different from one another, but there was a period where I did a lot of action pictures, I've done a lot of television, I've done a lot of, well, there's a lot of films that have a lot of African Americans in it, I can say that. And with each film, you have to really approach differently.
What was your favorite? I mean, you've done so many dozens of scores, but what was your favorite either to work on or in terms of how it came out?
You mentioned What's Love Got to Do with It. That film I really like because, you know, it's a heck of a story, you know, and the music, it's a very thematic score. If you really listen to it and really pay close attention to the music, there's a theme that I must lay this theme over the picture maybe 10 or 15 times during the course of the picture. And the cool thing about it is that, you know, I spent a lot of time just working on that one short theme.
So when you look at how you broke into the business, being someone who was, you know, you are, but you were in a musician role and then you were asked to compose, is it hard for African Americans to break into that part of the business?
Yes, it's always going to be hard because, you know, we as human beings, we thrive on familiarity. You know, we like to, it's kind of, bit of it is sad commentary. Maybe it's getting better. I don't notice it so much because I'm just a jazz musician. I'm in my own world. But I think people tend to want to be with their own kind and all that. So I have to tell you a little story. I remember one time, I'm not going to tell you what film it was that I did. It was a popular film, but I walked into this room to meet these directors, and these guys thought I was a white guy before they saw me. And I walked in. And the look on their face, I mean, it was just kind of, it was a shocking moment, you know, but it kind of brought a smile to my face because, you know, I take my job very serious. I was very prepared, and I was really more anxious to find out what their reaction was going to be after they spoke to me. I didn't really care the fact that I walked in there and I had an afro and had these big shoes on. I was looking good. I didn't care so much about that, but and when I finished my meeting with them, they were impressed and they hired me. And I must say that when I was doing a lot of this early film composing, I have to tell you that I did have the thought like that I was kind of laying a trail there, you know, because I think at that time it was myself, Quincy Jones, Herbie Hancock, really a handful of film composers that had done, you know, significant work in Hollywood. Now, there's quite a few, and I feel like I was part of that. Also, at that time, there was a resurgence in black cinema. You know, Spike Lee, then John Singleton came along. I did John's first three films, and so it was a very unique time for me. So it wasn't just me doing a film, getting paid, and going home. You know, there was something else there that sort of inspired me. I felt like I was trailblazing, and that's what I did.
How do you actually do this? I mean, do you start coming up with themes based on a script, or do you watch a rough cut? And how do you create something on a very practical level?
You know, we get a script, and you can start thinking about music, and you can even write music from a script. But I tend to like to watch the footage, then come up with the music, and from the point that you get the footage and then you start thinking about music, you go through something called a spotting session, meaning you have a session with the director and he'll spot places where you want music. That's why it's called a spotting session. And once you finish that, from that point to getting a finished product with music was what I call, half of it is magic and the other part is skill, like catching the human emotion. And I think that's the part you can't teach necessarily to people. I think you have to have some sort of, I would like to find another word, but I can't find it. There has to be a bit of humanity in your within your heart. You know, you have to have some understanding of people. I don't think a guy that's really has no understanding about people or has no interest in understanding people would make a good film composer, because in film, you know, you're dealing with all the dynamics of life. You know, one minute you can be dealing with love, the next minute somebody could be getting their head cut off, the next minute someone could be afraid to get their head cut off, the next minute could be a guy who regrets cutting the guy's head off. I mean, there's all these subtle emotions and different dynamics that you have to deal with, and somehow, you know, it has to go in your heart, and then from your heart it has to kind of come out in music.
There's a lot of musicians that are branching out and doing music for films. I think of the RZA. We were just talking about urban film, but he's a, you know, rap artist turned sometimes soundtrack composer. Do you see things moving in a particular artistic direction?
I think it's going to move in a lot of different directions. See, there's a lot of things happening. Number one, the directors now are younger, and they usually tend to want to have the music that they grew up with or music that they're into at that moment in their films. So for me, I'm kind of open. I think, you know, if you have some music in your soul and you're able to produce it however you can, you know, there's a musician there. I do miss, you know, the old days, you know, where you do a film, you get hired, and the guy says, write some music, and you write music, and you come back and you talk about that music, but not in relationship to a committee deciding based on something that some kids in Pasadena thought, you know. So, anyway.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating business.
Yeah.
Stanley Clark, thanks for talking to us.
All right.
That's jazz musician and film score composer Stanley Clark. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Now, if you've seen any of Spike Lee's movies, you'll probably recognize the music of Terrence Blanchard. You can hear his trademark trumpet on nearly 50 film scores from Barbershop to Malcolm X. As a young man, Terrence Blanchard left his hometown of New Orleans and headed to New York to make a name in jazz. After years of success, he moved on to composing film scores. Blanchard told me how he got involved in doing movie music.
I had been hired on, you know, several of Spike's earlier projects, School Days, Do the Right Thing, just as a session player. And when we were doing Mo Better Blues, Spike heard me playing something on a piano and asked if he could use it. And then we recorded it just as a solo trumpet piece. And then he asked if I could write a string arrangement for it, and I did. And Spike came over and he said, you have a talent for this and you have a future in the film business. And I said, okay, thank you. And I thought he was just being nice. But he called me to do Jungle Fever, and we've been working together ever since.
You've done so many things together, from feature films to documentaries. What is it like to collaborate? Because I'm sure that if he works with you as much as he does, he respects your talents and what you bring to the table as much as you respect his. So how do you guys communicate about what you want to accomplish when it comes to scoring a film?
There are general things, I mean, that Spike talked about when we first started working together. In terms of how he loves melody, he loves very thematic music. And once we got that out of the way, then the next hurdle has always been to try to derive a sonic palette for each film that's slightly different from the one that we're currently working on. We always talk about instrumentation, you know, the sound that we're going for. And we just kind of take it from there. I mean, Spike is a cinematic visionary, you know. So, you know, with those few simple requirements that I just talk to you about, they are very demanding, actually, because, you know, while he may want thematic music, sometimes those themes may get in the way of dialogue, and they have posed challenges for me in the past.
Terrence, when some people think about movie music, they think, okay, well, these are a couple songs I'll buy for a soundtrack, or this is just the mustard and relish on the side, or, you know, a little condiment, or it's not even important, I don't even listen to it. How do you think of the music?
It varies from director to to director and film the film, actually. But, you know, mostly with Spike, Spike always views his music as being a separate character, a whole nother piece to the puzzle, if you will. And he's always paid a lot of respect to the music, you know, not only mine, but the incidental music as well.
When you were faced with either the dailies or the rough cut or the script, how do you think about story?
Oh, you have to. You have to think about the story. You have to think about the big picture, because within any story there's an arc, and you have to make sure that the music enhances those places that need to be enhanced within that arc. You have to stay within the context of the story, but at the same time there could be many variables. So I'm constantly thinking about the big picture, you know, not necessarily what the music should do at any given point, but where is it going? You know, where is it ultimately going to end up?
We've been talking a lot about the marriage between film and story and the music that you create. So why don't you tell us why the themes for 25th Hour and Inside Man worked for those films? Let's listen to a little bit from the 25th Hour. What about that really resonated with you? Why did you create it?
Well, I mean, when you listen to some of the music in 25th Hour, you know, Spike wanted to make sure that that music kept you in a post 9/11 New York. And so in my mind, that meant bagpipes, that meant iris flutes, which represented New York Police Department and the Fire Department. It also meant to me that there was Arabic percussion and Arabic vocals that could have been used, which represented Al-Qaeda. And in various scenes throughout, you know, 25th Hour, you'll hear those elements, you know, throughout any given scene, which subliminally should keep you in the mindset that this is after 9/11. And it gives a certain type of flavor to the film.
What about Inside Man?
Inside Man is a little different in that, you know, Denzel's character is kind of like an old school cop, you know, so hence the R&B type of groove that you will hear under the main theme in some various spots in that particular film. I tried to draw upon some of the old school R&B grooves to kind of give him more of a flavor, because to me his character reminded me of some of my uncles, you know,
mm-hmm.
guys who were very serious about what they did, you know, and very good at their jobs, but also loved their music.
What's the benefit and what's the risk of trying to do film work? I mean, I'm sure that on some level there's only 24 hours in a day,
uh-huh.
and you have to make decisions about where you're going to put your time. How do you, for example, make those decisions?
Well, the thing about doing film work is that the limitations are the things that actually make you creative, you know, because not having the type of time you would really want to write this music, it forces you to make choices. And it forces you to, you know, come to the point where you have to live with those choices. And the more you do it, the better you become at it, you know. And my background as a jazz musician has always aided me in that regard, being able to think quickly on my feet. But at the same time, you know, it's made me learn how to really organize my time. You know, when I get a film, the first thing I try to do is break it down structurally. I try to, you know, identify certain thematic things that may occur. And then once I get all of those things set aside in my mind, structurally, and how the score should evolve, then it makes scoring it that much easier, actually.
In a 1994 interview for Downbeat magazine, you said, "Writing for film is fun, but nothing can beat being a jazz musician, playing a club, playing a concert."
Mm-hmm.
Do you still think that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, live performance for me has always been where it's at. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, there are different forms of expression, so they all have their pluses and minuses. you know, the film thing allows me to be creative, you know, with different sonic textures, different size ensembles, and different musical genres. Whereas, you know, the immediacy of playing with a band is something totally different, you know, because the guys may throw something at me musically and then I'll respond, which will make us go in a certain musical direction one night, which will be different from the night prior to it and probably will yet be different the next night. So that kind of excitement, that kind of creative energy is something that I've always yearned and I've always cherished, you know. So I have a lot of fun playing live.
Terrence Blanchard, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Terrence Blanchard is an internationally renowned jazz trumpeter, bandleader, composer, and film score writer. We spoke to him while he was on the road touring from Gainesville, Florida. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On August 3, 1908, Colonel Allen Allensworth filed the site plan to start a town in California's San Joaquin Valley. He was born a slave in 1842 in Louisville, Kentucky, and went on to serve in the military. He eventually moved to California, where he purchased 800 acres in Tulare County along the Santa Fe rail line. The town of Allensworth became the first in California to be founded and funded solely by African Americans. At its height, it had a bustling economy with a schoolhouse, a church, and a library. Allensworth is celebrating its 100th anniversary, and for some perspective, we turn to Lonnie Bunch. He's the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Lonnie, great to have you back on the show.
My pleasure.
So, Allensworth, founded 100 years ago in California's Central Valley. Describe what it was like to be a black person in that area at that historical moment.
Well, imagine, if you will, it's the time in America when segregation is the law of the land, when discrimination against African Americans was the norm rather than being unusual. It was a time when 100 black men per year were lynched in the South. It was a time when most blacks lived in the South and were stuck in low-level jobs, sharecroppers, porters, maids. It was a time when it was hard for people, especially African Americans, to believe that there would be a better day, and yet they did. And Allensworth was really an example of how a community came together to believe, but also to work hard to find a better day.
So who was the man after whom this town is named?
Allensworth, great name, one of the most interesting figures in history. This is a guy who was born as a slave in Kentucky, ultimately after two tries, escapes, becomes a freeman, and joins the United States Navy because he wants to participate in the Civil War. After serving in the Navy in the Civil War, he basically has a religious conversion, becomes a minister around Knoxville and Nashville, Tennessee, and then he stumbles upon a soldier who says to him, you know, we need black chaplains in the military. In those days, there were four units, the 9th and 10th Cavalry, the 24th, 25th Infantry. He applied to be the chaplain of the 24th Infantry. He was there for 20 years, retired as lieutenant colonel, came to California because he had been there many times with his troop, and was stunned by the discrimination he faced in Southern California and decided, along with four other men, that they would create a colony somewhere in California where, quote, the Negro could be free of prejudice.
So Allensworth was meant to be a haven from discrimination, and it wasn't the only town of its type.
Well, what happens is that there have been a history of African-American towns in Massachusetts, in New Jersey, Boley, Oklahoma, Nicodemus, Kansas. And so Allensworth, on the surface, is just like that, an attempt to create an oasis free of racism. But what I think is so exciting about Allensworth as a community is that they recognize that what they were doing was greater than them. While they definitely wanted to have a community where there could be black businessmen and shopkeepers and school teachers, they recognized that their mission was bigger. If they could be a successful community and show economic progress and show leadership, they felt that would be a beacon of change that would echo around the country, that people would see Allensworth and say African Americans can control their own destiny, can be contributing members of American society, and their hope would be that would help to change the racial dynamics in this country.
Of course, you move on, and troubled times hit. The colonel died in 1914 in a motorcycle accident, and that was just the start of a series of problems that really changed Allensworth. What happened?
Allensworth, as a community, was really in an area where water was key. And when the land was acquired, they were promised that there would always be pumps and there'd always be the kind of level of water they needed. And that failed. And once the water started to go, that called in the question their ability to farm. They also made a business of being a depot station where the farmers from the local area would come to put their crops because the Santa Fe Railroad train would go through there. But the farmers complained that they had to deal with these black people, and ultimately a spur was created to bypass, for the railroad to bypass Allensworth. That took some of the business away. And then the notion was Allensworth thought that maybe we could create a Tuskegee of the West, a school like Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, a vocational school for blacks. That could be in Allensworth, and that would provide both an economic engine for the community, but also a real practical purpose for this community. That failed. And then when the colonel is killed in run down by a motorcycle in 1914, suddenly the community doesn't have the bearings it once had.
Let's listen to a little bit from one of the one-time residents, Ed Pope. He recently died, but here he is talking to filmmaker Pam Harris about the time right before World War II.
We left Allensworth. That was in 1940. A lot of people were still here, and they just hung on. But when the war started, and from 41 started, and jobs started to open up in the different cities, that's when everyone left. That was the last great days of Allensworth.
You can hear in his voice this heartbreak. What lessons are we meant to learn from the life cycle of Allensworth, which is by some people called the town that wouldn't die? I mean, it's now still exists as a state historic park, but it's not what it was.
I think that in some ways, there's a lot to learn from Allensworth. First of all, Allensworth was a place that helped people believe, helped people find some positive thing to hold on to when the rest of the world told them there was no possibility there. And many of the people who came out of Allensworth, as you heard in Ed Pope's voice, there was a sense of community, a sense of engagement, a sense of helping each other, but also a sense that this was, in some ways, a special moment where the possibilities that were once there were now gone. And so I think one of the powers of understanding Allensworth is that this is really a proactive attempt by an African-American community not to simply disassociate itself from America, but to be a kind of beacon of hope, a beacon of possibility. And some ways its greatest impact is that the people that once lived there became people who believed in education, believed in change, believed that they could make America better.
Lonnie, thank you so much.
It's my great pleasure.
Lonnie Bunch is the founding director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. He joined us from the NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. To see an excerpt from the film Land of Promise, The Story of Allensworth, go to our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. Now for more on Allensworth, we turn to one-time resident Mrs. Alice Royal. She's the author of Allensworth, The Freedom Colony, a California African-American Township. Mrs. Royal, it's a delight to have you on the show.
It is good to be here.
So you were born in Allensworth in 1923 in your grandparents'
home. Correct.
In your grandparents' home?
Exactly. Mr. and Mrs. Alice and James Hackett.
What are some of the things you remember from being a little girl and going around their house?
Well, I remember my grandmother because I used to follow her everywhere, in the home, in her garden, and she raised all of her vegetables and her condiments for cooking. And then across the road, she had her cows and her chickens. I tried to help her collect the eggs because the chickens knew her better than they knew me. So I just had to watch and cautiously try to reach the eggs every day.
Or else you'd get a peck on
they
the
were
hand.
Rhode Island red chickens, and of course the eggs were brown and were supposed to be the most nourishing. And then with the cow, I also tried to milk the cow, but I didn't do a very good job as an 8-year-old. And so most of the time I just watched and helped my mother and my grandmother with the milk and the cream and the churning in the home.
What do you remember about the other people in the town? Did people congregate?
They were very loving, gracious people because my grandparents were highly respected in the community. And then so many of the community members were friends. Some of them were church members, and some of them were educators. Some of them were business people. And we were welcome when we went to the post office. We were welcome when we went to the drugstore. We were welcome when we went to the other stores in the community. And, of course, my aunt was a teacher in the school during my day. And so on special occasions, we had taffy pulls in the Hackett home for all the children in the community. And, of course, that was a joy time as well.
Do you feel that the community was protected, at least at first, from some of the tensions that were going on around race in other parts of the country?
Very true. And so I never knew of any struggles or any of the kinds of things that went on in many city times of the age. There was no policemen. Everything was quiet and peaceful and well run.
How did you feel when Allensworth started to change because of the railroad issue and then ultimately in the 1970s becoming a state historic park? How did it make you feel that this town, which you describe as being so very vibrant, it lives on, but not in the form that it used to?
This is very true. One of the things that even after leaving Allensworth, members of my family were in and out of Allensworth up through the Depression years and up through the years where Allensworth was struggling. But there was always a gathering of the few pioneers, usually during May. Wherever they were, they wanted to come back to Allensworth and have a big picnic and a sharing of pioneer experiences.
How does it make you feel that this anniversary is being celebrated, this centennial?
I'm blessed. I am blessed to carry on what I call a vibrant community, a community of former ex-slaves, former freed people that always had an upward vision. I call the Allensworth pioneers VIA people, people with vision, the intellect, and the ability to carry out their dream of an upward movement, to be freed people with their skills, with their abilities, with their education in a segregated world.
Well, Mrs. Royal, really appreciate this. Thank you.
And thank you.
That was Mrs. Alice Royal. She's a one-time resident of Allensworth and author of Allensworth, The Freedom Colony, a California African-American Township. She joined me from the studios of KVPR in Fresno, California. And finally, we've got a gentleman with a completely different perspective on embracing Allensworth's history. Thomas Ward is a bike ride coordinator for the Colonel Allensworth Century and Fun Ride and owner of Crankin' Time Cycling. Thomas, thanks for coming in the studio.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So tell us about this bike ride that you helped organize.
Yes, I am working with the Friends of Allensworth, a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping expose people to Colonel Allensworth State Park. And I decided to do it along the lines of promoting with a bike ride, having a central event for people to ride and also learn about the park.
How'd you learn about it?
I learned about the park as a musician. I was playing there and I had to leave and I wanted to stay and I couldn't stay and I decided to come back on my own. And when I did, I decided I wanted to promote it for other people to see as well.
So when you organize a ride like this that raises money for Allensworth, what are you really raising money to do? What do you want to see happen with the town?
Well, they have a nonprofit organization through California State Parks, but they also have a subdivision, which is the Friends of Allensworth, and those people are the ones that actually provide tourists with people dressed in period clothing. I guess they call them docents. And I'm inspired to try to help the docents. You know, a lot of them come from miles around and they spend their own money to, you know, give people like me a tour. And I would like to give some money to them.
You guys have set up a, you know, a very comprehensive event with three different rides for people of different abilities. You know, one is a beginner, no hills, and then you go on from there. Tell me, describe the hardcore ride to me, the one that the tough cyclist will do.
The hardcore hill is called the Granite Wall. That's a 100-mile ride, a little over 100 miles. It's a little over 3,000 feet total climbing.
Why does it make you excited to do this kind of work?
I feel very strongly about letting our people, African Americans, know about a history that they can walk into and take a look at and see for themselves what was done, you know, years ago. In this case, you know, 100 years ago. These were people that had different obstacles to deal with in their time, and they were still able to band together, organize both financially and with labor, and build a town. And when you walk there and you see that, it just puts a chill over you that these people said, we have class, we have desires, we want to raise our children safely, we want to educate ourselves, and this is what we tried to do.
Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Thomas Ward, the bike ride coordinator for the second annual Allensworth Century and Fun Ride Centennial Celebration. That took place this weekend, and he joined us in our studios here at NPR West.